From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. If you've been listening to the ER, you're in the right place. But we have a new name. We decided on First Person because it describes what we've been doing on the show for the past few months. Each week, we talk to one person whose story tells us something timely and important about the world. I'll have more about the new name later in the podcast, but first, today's topic, Saudi Arabia. It's been a few weeks since Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was apparently killed inside his country's consulate in Istanbul. And still many questions remain unanswered.
Why did Saudi Arabia send an autopsy expert if, as some of its media outlets have been claiming, the plan was only to question Khashoggi? And where is Jamal Khashoggi's body? How did the Saudi government not know of the operation?
Khashoggi was a contributor to the Washington Post and a moderate critic of the Saudi monarchy. Though the kingdom has strongly denied ordering the hit, the evidence compiled by Turkey appears to link Khashoggi's death to men in Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's close circle.
One man, Maher Mutreb, is listed on a British diplomatic roster as being assigned to the Saudi embassy in London back in 2007, according to the Times. Since then, the Times reports that he's been seen traveling with the Crown Prince all over the world, potentially as a bodyguard. A French professional who's worked with the Saudi royal family.
Khashoggi's death undermines the narrative that Saudi Arabia has been reforming under Mohammed bin Salman. And it sent ripples of terror through the community of Saudi dissidents around the world. One of those dissidents, Manal al-Sharif, is our guest this week. Back in 2011, she got behind the wheel of a car in Saudi Arabia and went for a drive. It was a small act of protest in a country where restrictions on women are vast. But it had a huge effect. Manal was in prison briefly. She eventually left Saudi Arabia and settled in Australia. But she left her son behind. Manal, welcome to First Person.
Thank you for having me here.
So I very much want to go back and hear your story about driving and about activism. But before I do, I can't help but start with Jamal Khashoggi and how you and other Saudi dissidents have been thinking and feeling over the last week or so since he disappeared. And are you hearing from other dissidents? Are you talking amongst yourselves?
So the family and friends have been asking me to be quiet. First of all, they're too afraid of retaliation from the government because this is what they do. They could go and target your family. So I just had to...
You mean your family that are still in Saudi or you
that
mean
are still
your family
in Saudi,
all over the
yes,
world?
Yes, yes. And also my friends, my close friends. And it was so shocking to me, Saudi Arabia, they have completely different side of the story. Everyone are saying it's a conspiracy against the government, against Saudi. We've been under attack. We have a lot of enemies outside. And that's what you hear from people there. And I'm not talking about trolls. I'm not talking about pro-government. I'm talking about people like me there, living there in Saudi Arabia. Attacking me, I've heard things like you've been paid by Qatar to say these things, which is amazing. It's just horrendous how people in Saudi Arabia are blindsided. Outside Saudi Arabia, thankfully, I started receiving emails from other dissidents, other people who are quietly left the country, living abroad on asylum. And I'm talking about people living in Europe, in Australia, in the US. They're all over the world. None of them can live in the Middle East. And they've been intimidated. The government sends one of my friends, I can't mention where she lives, but the government sent her people from the culture attaché, asking her to participate in one of their events. They've been trying to get her. Her scholarship was discontinued. They wouldn't renew her passport. They asked her to go back to Saudi Arabia to renew her passport. So they target any outspoken people outside. And if you are inside, you just disappear, and no one knows when you disappear.
Are you afraid?
I'm just afraid for my family, not for myself. Like, what's the worst my government can do to me? What is the worst they can do to me? Kill me? Thank you. I'll be fine if I'm killed because it just not put me in jail and put my family in jail and what happened to Lujain in the solitary confinement. She lost her husband and no one knows how long she's going to be in jail. That's a fate I don't want to have. I'd rather be outside and outspoken, and I'm completely there. I think more scared when people are outspoken than people who are speaking. what my government is doing. They try to silence everyone because they know they're not right. If you're doing the right thing, you wouldn't go and kill journalists because they've been outspoken about the injustice and about the violation of human rights and the imprisonment of outspoken people in the country.
Did you know Jamal Khashoggi yourself?
So Jamal is one of the people who was openly supportive of the right to drive. And knowing Jamal, he's a public figure in Saudi Arabia. He held very important positions, advisor to some of the officials. He was editor-in-chief for Al Watan newspaper, and we were writing in the CNN newspaper. I only wrote 2 years, but he wrote years and years for them. And I had a call, one phone call with Jamal. At the time, we were under attack, the movement, calling us spies, agents to the West, being funded by the state enemies. I remember that phone call where he expressed his support to what we do and his belief. And it meant so much to me, knowing he was so close also to the Islamists in Saudi Arabia, people like Salman al-Ouda and Awad al-Ghirni. So he was close to those people who are, they were the ones very conservative, and we were expecting more resistance from those people. It's very complicated, Jamal Khashoggi life. It's really complicated.
Let's go back to 2011 and when you decided to take the wheel. What brought you to that point?
Necessity. It wasn't really being revolutionary or anything. We were really fueled and inspired by the revolutions around us, the Arab revolutions. And we thought, oh my God, we can use social media and call a day of action. It was really necessity. I was a divorced mother with a child, and I had a car and a driver's license. And I found out there is no law that bans us from driving. And it was just calling women to drive on a certain day.
You had actually lived in the United States and gotten a driver's license here, correct?
Yes, but again, the United States has nothing to do with that decision of starting the movement, Women to Drive movement, because a lot of people still tie my 1 year in the state that it's the one who inspired that. So living in the state, it was more of liberating that me as a woman, I can live a normal life. Me as a woman, there's no difference between me and men at the workplace. That was an eye-opener to me, but I was very curious. I always questioned these things before I went to the U.S. I've always fought my company, Saudi Aramco, for their discriminative laws against me as a woman employee. So it's been always there. I think it's just with the Arab Spring and the social media, I think that was very empowering. It was just the right timing.
So you decided to take the wheel, and there are several moments in the spring of 2011 when you're behind the wheel, but you actually were arrested before the June 2011 action. That was a sort of a mass action. Can you tell me about the night that you were arrested? What happened?
So the way I was arrested tells you the way Saudi government deals with outspoken people. So I was arrested twice. The first time they let me go after signing a pledge promising never to drive again on Saudi lands. But the second time they came to my house at 2 a.m., secret police, they didn't have a warrant. They were not wearing uniforms. That tells you the type of government you deal with. They took me from my house at 2 a.m. My son was there in the house. They sent me to jail. No trial. I didn't see a lawyer. My family didn't know about it. But that minute when they took me in the middle of the night, I had the number of a CNN reporter that she did an interview earlier with me that week. I called her and I said, there are people outside. I have no clue where they're taking me. Please report on this. I was so thankful I had her number, and I'm so thankful, Atika Sherbet. I still remember her. She posted that on the CNN, and the world picked it up from there. Otherwise, I would have gone missing, exactly as Jamal Khashoggi. He would have gone missing if his fiancée wasn't outside the embassy. I have friends who have gone missing, and no one knows about them.
So you feel strongly that the outside pressure, media attention, both brought attention to your story and allowed you to be released?
I do believe in that. I do believe that the international attention was huge on Saudi Arabia to let me go. And I also believe that because I come from Sharif family, and Sharif family were the rulers before the Al Saud, the prince of our tribe, he went with my father to the king. And they had to let me out. So it's like a combination of both. It's not only the international media, but also if you understand how complicated the Saudi society and the protocols there, it got in the way. Jamal Khashoggi, he doesn't come from a tribe. They immigrated, Khashoggi family, they immigrated hundreds of years ago to Saudi Arabia. So they don't have tribes in Saudi Arabia where they can use that protocol to go to the king.
What gave you the wherewithal to actually continue with driving activism, though, after you were arrested? And I'm curious, you said that you'd researched the law and saw that there was no clause that said that a woman couldn't drive. It was simply custom to not allow women to drive. What gave you the wherewithal to continue to do that and also not just drive, but to film yourself doing it and broadcast that?
I think, again, what I mentioned is necessity. When you are an adult woman in your 30s and you have a child and you are fully independent, you pay your own rent, you buy your own food, you pay even for your family's apartment rent, which I still, until this day, I pay for my father's apartment rent. He's 83. And you live as a child, you live as a minor in your home country because you're just a woman. That makes you want to fight the system. Because it doesn't matter if there are laws. It doesn't matter. Slavery was legalized once. Doesn't make it okay. So it wasn't really about the driving itself. It was more of acknowledging me as an adult woman, as someone who is capable to take care of herself and take decisions, and not only drive her own car, but drive her own life. And I've faced so much pressure from the family first. And this is what they do. They intimidate you so much. And they cut you from your family. They make sure you're intimidated at work. And I was intimidated so much at work from colleagues. My brother had to even leave. We were working in the same company. So they put all pressure around you to shut you up. And the more pressure they put around you, the more you realize you are right. If it wasn't that wrong, why they would fight you badly, lie, create conspiracy theories around you, try to harass you at work and outside, make your life impossible, because it was right, because they were intimidated. They don't want to give away the power to the people. And that what made me really continue. When my mom used to call me crying, can you just please stop? And I told my mom, I will stop on the day the women start driving. But unfortunately, that day came and all the women who fought for the driving ban, the prominent ones, were sent to jail. They are now in jail.
So I wanted to ask you about that. How did you feel when Mohammed bin Salman came to power? Did you think it was a new era for reform in Saudi Arabia?
He was the deputy crown prince. He didn't have that much power as a deputy crown prince. But in June 2017, when he became the crown prince and ousted his cousin, Mohammed bin Naif. Mohammed bin Naif, he was one of the, what would I say, coolest minister of interiors in Saudi Arabia. They were building more jails for political prisoners and outspoken people than hospitals in my country. When he ousted his cousin, we were so, so hopeful. We were really having big dreams that we have a young leader who will change the country, who will lift it up from this prehistory era that we lived in as men and women. And I know some of my activist friends, they came back to Saudi Arabia. They're Shia. One of them, he applied for asylum with his family. He wanted to apply for asylum with his family in Germany. And we were texting the day he became the crown prince. And we were just congratulating each other that, oh my God, Saudi Arabia will never be the same again. It's time to go back home. And I was preparing to go back home. But what was happening with Qatar, what was happening with Yemen, it was making us question. And then I received two phone calls from the national security on the day they announced lifting the ban in September 26th. And I'm like, how did they get my number in Australia? Oh my God, am I monitored here in Australia? And that really raised a lot of suspicions. But I was still kept my hope until the last minute that my country will change. It's sad that it has this, one of the youngest nations in the world is Saudi Arabia. Very well-educated people and very kind people. Some of the oldest civilizations in the world is in that country. We have the two holy cities. It's got so much potential. to be one of the biggest powers in the Muslim world today. They don't realize how much hurt they're doing to the Muslim world and the Muslims around the world by leading the country in that way.
After you're jailed and after you're at the beginning of your activism, you do end up leaving Saudi Arabia and you have to leave behind your son. But for some time, you were able to commute between Dubai and Saudi Arabia and see him. When was the last time you were home?
January 25 this year. My son turns 13 on October 30, in 2 weeks from now, and I'm not able to see him. And he was texting me on WhatsApp, and he was asking me if I'm kind of... I never missed his birthday. And I told him, Aboudi, we don't know what's happening in Saudi Arabia. My friends are in jail. It's very dangerous for mom to come here. He was crying for like 30 minutes. I couldn't explain to him what is happening. He's too young to understand. And I'm like, Aboudi, I will never give up on you. One day we will meet again. And one day you and your brother will be united. And this is just one story. There are hundreds of stories of families being separated, of families being broken, of people disappearing. They keep telling us they are being funded by enemies. And then when you know people very well, who they're close friends, who work together with you, and then they take them and they sell you the same story. This is just bullshit. I'm sorry to curse.
When in September 2017, when it was announced that women would be allowed to drive, you said that you felt celebratory. But as you noted just now, just before the ruling went into effect to allow women to drive, a number of women's rights driving activists were imprisoned, and some of them remain in prison. Why is that? Can you explain it?
According to MBS, he said they have videos and audio connecting them with enemies, Iran and Qatar. And I know this is not true. And I dare the Saudi government to get these videos and audios they claim and publish them. And I dare the Saudi government to assign lawyers to these women and press charges against them and tell us where they are locked. And I dare Saudi Arabia government to tell us, who are these enemies? They were funding us. It's so funny that those activists that I know, they were broke. They've been targeted in their jobs and their businesses. And they tell you we accepted money from the West or from whoever to say terrible things about it. We're just speaking the truth. We're just speaking up. Those women, and I want to name them, please keep the names. Lujain al-Hadloul, she's the youngest. She's just turned 29 in jail. Iman al-Nafjan, she's a mother of three. Her youngest is 2 years old. She's a lecturer, English lecturer, and Saudi woman blogger. Dr. Aziz al-Yusuf, retired professor. She's a grandmother in her 60s. Dr. Hatoun al-Fassi, she's a mother of two. And I know her husband, I know her kids. Nasima al-Sada, she's from the Shia sect in Saudi Arabia. And Samar Badawi, voted one of the bravest women in the world. Those women are in jail. No one knows where they're locked. No one have access to them. Lujain, I know that she was in solitary confinement with no sunlight because she's a really strong woman. They really wanted to break her. Why they do this to these women? Why they kidnap them? Why Lujain was kidnapped from UAE? Why her husband Fahad was kidnapped from Jordan? Why when they kidnap them, they force her husband to divorce her? Why they're so intimidated by people for just peacefully tweeting and speaking about human rights?
There are defenders of Mohammed bin Salman who say that Saudi Arabia can't reform too quickly or it will trigger a backlash from the Wahhabi clerics. What do you think of that argument? Does it justify it? Does it explain something?
Talking about reforms, what type of reforms that allow you to target people and kill them? What type of reforms that allow you to put people under surveillance, to intimidate them, to make them disappear? He's not doing any political reforms. I'm just seeing more oppression happening. If these economic reforms are going to come with harsher dictatorship than the one we lived under all my life, accompanied with a very strict Islamic rule and interpretation of the Islamic texts, which is the Wahhabi Islam. We don't want these reforms.
I want to go back for a moment to the driving activism question, and I wonder if it, the major stake undergirding it is the issue of male guardianship. I mean, you mentioned earlier that women are minors in Saudi Arabia. Can you explain what it is that women need to ask men to do just to live life?
So, Saudi Arabia, they follow the strict interpretation of Islamic text, and they claim that a woman needs a male guardian to literally do anything in her life. That's the narrative that we've been fighting, that I'm adult. Once I reach the age of 18, I'm an adult and I can take my own decisions. And that's a problem we face in Saudi Arabia as women. And the worst problem is not that. The worst problem, we as women, we were so brainwashed and we were defending these rules because they convince us we are queens and queens have to be served. And this is why men are the ones doing everything for you. But that led to horrendous, horrendous violations for women's rights in my country. And I'm not talking only about the guardianship. The guardianship, it is the worst of evil. But you have things like child marriage. I have friends who've been forced into marriage at the age of 13, and she had her first child at the age of 15. That should be illegal. I was subject to female genital mutilation when I was 8 years old. I almost died. I was bleeding for 3 days. That should be criminalized in my country. They don't even acknowledge it exists in my country. Women are too ashamed to come out and say, yes, I was circumcised when I was a child. These terrible things happening there to women, no one is bringing them up. And if you're bringing them up, oh, it's an individual case, or it's a family matter, like domestic violence. So you're fighting with a system that doesn't acknowledge the problem existed, that actually tell you that this is not a problem. This is actually to protect you. This is why we're having this system in place.
When did you realize that you had been subject to female genital mutilation? And is it something that women aren't speaking about in any way?
Unfortunately, women don't talk about it. Like, it took me years of talking to friends around me and they won't open up. Even my cousins, when I talk to them, they won't talk. And then later, when they are into going through some emotional time of their life, they tell me, yes, I've been circumcised at this age, twice, when I was born and when I was 8 or when I was 10. And all my aunties are circumcised. I'm like, wow, so it took you all these years to finally. So they feel ashamed. So they make the victims ashamed. So they don't share their story. They're too afraid to share that she's been physically abused by her parents or her husband. So they can't even talk about it. Because once you talk about it, you're labeled by not being a good girl, by being a bad girl. And that's the thing we're trying to empower them, give them a voice and a space where they can talk and expose these violations against them in a safe way. Unfortunately, we don't have that in Saudi Arabia. So it takes you to go. My friend is queer. She just sent me an invitation. She's Saudi from my city, Mecca. And she just sent me yesterday an invitation to attend her the events where she's going to talk about openly about her story. She would not be able to do that if she's living in Saudi Arabia. And she's Saudi.
Tell me for a moment about how you grow up. You were born in Mecca, and I know you've said that you melted down your brother's music tapes and that you yourself felt radicalized. When did that change for you?
Yes, I did. I grew up radical Muslim, fully covered up. I didn't believe that music or art, although I'm an artist myself, I had to destroy all my art pieces when they told me it was haram. It was against God's will to compete with him in his creations by drawing animals and people. I was a very curious person. Every time I asked questions, I was shut down. We were not allowed to ask questions, and we were really led by hate. And hate is very, very strong feeling and emotion to live with hate. Hate against anything that's different than us, because we're the only true religion. We are the ones we're going to go to heaven. Actually, I sometimes believe Saudi women cannot go to hell because you can't go to hell twice. When I grew up and when we had internet, I had this talent of bypassing all the... And this is why I work now in information security, because I'm good in these things. So I used to bypass any censored website. I used to bypass and break into things to just... I was so curious. I wanted to read these books that I couldn't read. I wanted to access this information that was banned from us. And that really led to knowing that all the beliefs I defended all my life were all one-sided. And this is just a message to anyone. Whatever you believe in today, always question it. When it doesn't feel right, it's not because you're wrong. No, because it is wrong. I think it was also just being in connection with my inner guts. A lot of things I was questioning, like, why? Because I'm a woman, I can't do this. Why? We have hate against the other. And all it made sense to me when I started understanding where it came from.
When you left Saudi Arabia for Dubai, you mentioned your son, and you don't know that you can go back for his birthday this year. But you also wrote an essay for the New York Times talking about how he couldn't travel to you and that you don't actually have legal custody over him. Is that still true?
That is true, but that's... So I took my ex-husband to the court. It took me 2 years, and I lost. And they said, if he travels with me, he is in danger because of the long route. And they used text from like 1,000 years ago when they used to travel using caravans and camels, not airplanes. It was so funny that I was against a system that used prehistory text that justify taking my son away from me. And his dad can allow him to come and visit me, but he won't. It's welcome to the life of Saudi women when they're deprived from their children based on whatever judge is there or whatever the father wants. I've been hearing from my friends that things are getting better for women there, but still, they can't even take them out of the country if she decided to go and study abroad. And I have friends here who are students. She can't have her children with her. My other son, Daniel Hamza, from my second husband, my marriage was not approved by the government, and I wasn't allowed even to take him back home to Saudi Arabia. I've never seen my home country.
You've been tweeting quite a bit lately, and October 14th, you actually posted a number of hopeless-sounding tweets. You said that for the first time in your life that you're hopeless, and you wrote, don't fight the system, don't have hopes, don't speak up. What did you mean by that?
If you are in Saudi Arabia, it's dangerous. You will be taken away. It's not the time to do anything. Right now, the only thing you can do if you live inside Saudi Arabia is to be quiet. Because if you speak up now in Saudi Arabia, they will just take you away.
Could you have done what you did, the activism that you have done since 2011, the speeches you've given, the work you've done around the world talking about your story? Do you think you could have done that now? Will this chill speech around the world?
I would never know. But what I know is I know people been disappearing. Very good friends of mine that we've known them for years, although only on Twitter. They took them quietly. All of them are in jail today. No one knows where they are. It's very, very dangerous now in Saudi Arabia. Us outside will keep speaking up. They will not silence us. But if you are inside Saudi Arabia, it's really dangerous. My hope, I gave up hope on governments, whether European governments, UK or the US, but I have my hope that businesses and business people, those are the ones who will boycott Saudi Arabia, will not be part or involved with the proclaimed economic reforms because there are huge human rights violations going on now in Saudi Arabia. It's so dangerous to speak up now in Saudi Arabia. Inside, if you are inside the country. But for us outside, we will stay outspoken.
Manal, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sara. Thank you. Have a good day.
Before we leave today, a little bit more about our new name, First Person. Our old name, the ER, stood for Editor's Roundtable, but we'd been moving away from the roundtable format for some time. Instead, we've been interviewing one guest each week, usually people who participated directly in world events, either as protagonists or witnesses. We get them to tell a story about their experience, not just offer analysis. The shift is driven in part by the feeling here at Foreign Policy that to understand our world, we need to get as close to the source as possible, hence the name First Person. We hope you'll keep listening and tell your friends about the show. First Person is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs, with additional help this week from Lawrence Bull. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I've been your host.